netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. In this episode of the podcast, our guest is James McLaughlin, the overall visual effects supervisor for Black Mirror Season 7, focusing specifically on the highly anticipated sequel to the USS Callister episode. McLaughlin provides an in-depth look at the challenge of revisiting and expanding upon one of Black Mirror's most successful episodes, balancing a faithful homage to the original while incorporating new gaming aesthetics and other new visual effects. The episode was nominated for multiple Emmy Awards, including Outstanding Special Visual Effects in a Single Episode, and other apps were nominated in several categories as well. Before we dive into it, I just want to mention that we have another FX podcast covering the USS Callister Into Infinity episode, that one with the team from Union FX. You can find that up from back in May at fxguide.com/fxpodcast. Okay, so let's go ahead and join the conversation now between Mike and James.
So thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
So this is a really interesting episode because we're revisiting ground that existed before. I guess, does that pose both a delight to you and a kind of a trepidation about like going over and a sort of attacking an episode that's been so successful in the past?
Well spotted. There's a lot of very faithful fans to the previous episode before our sequel. So, yeah, it was slightly daunting task, making sure that we were going to keep all of those wonderful viewers happy, but exciting at the same time in that it extended beyond where it got to last time. So obviously previously we had that 65 and now we're looking more into the future of gaming. So we were very lucky that there were enough differences there to make it really exciting to work on, but also a really strong foundation.
Yeah, I mean, there were assets that you'd used in the past and then brand new assets. In terms of just asset management, though, how much could you rely on what you'd already built in terms of the main spaceship and stuff? And how much did you have to like say, okay, well, that looks great, but different pipeline, different methodology?
As you well know, last time around, obviously, it was many years ago and VFX obviously reinvents itself every couple of years. So we were very fortunate in that Framestore were able to hand over the asset of the Callister to Union, Union VFX being our main vendor for the space battle and those shots. And so we reskinned, relit, retextured, reanimated, obviously, for all of the shots. So there was a small handover, which was very wonderful of the guys at Framestore to do. And then Union took it up and ran with it. And aside from that handover, everything was all bespoke and new for this season.
Am I right in thinking there was a couple of hundred shots of which at least, what, a quarter of those were like fully CG? Is that about right?
Yeah, more than 200, yeah.
So in terms of the aesthetic of the show, you actually are balancing two things, aren't you? Because you're balancing the aesthetic of the previous episode and then there's this entire overlaid retro gaming aesthetic, which many of us just love to death. So it's kind of like you're serving almost two masters, unless you found that to be one and the same.
I think what was really lovely was the way Charlie Brooker, obviously the writer of the show, he has a deep understanding of gaming. He was a journalist in gaming for many years. And so his understanding of what we needed to achieve on that front was fairly straightforward. And working with Toby Haynes, who obviously directed the first one and then this one as well, they were able to layer in what they felt was the appropriate level of gamification, as it were, into all of these elements. I think there was a few moments where we tried some things in VFX at a concept level, like when people were fragged, they initially turned into sort of shattered glass. But then we leaned more into the gaming and they became cubes and fell apart. And those sorts of little things, the differences between it feeling real world but having that gamification layer across the top was led by Toby and Charlie. And obviously the guys at Union and the guys at all the other vendors leaned into that, and we went through solid concepting of everything before we hit shot production.
I'm not after gossip, but did you ever discover whether they actually thought they were going to do a second ep, or was it sort of a production secret, or was it just like, hey, guess what? Doing something new, we're doing something we've done before.
I think Initially, it was a more extended set of sequences. I think I've heard a rumor that it was going into this season, it was going to be shorter eps, but more of them. So there might have been two eps or three eps. But the way it was written and the way it was condensed, it became a single sort of movie length sequel to the previous ones. So coming into this, I wasn't involved in the first one the first time around. So my involvement began at the beginning of season 7. And by that point in time, it was one longer episode.
Right.
Sequel to the original.
So discuss the Heart of the Infinity, the sort of massive mega gyroscopic structure. That's interesting at so many levels to me, but how much was it already solved by production design, or like when VFX got to it, was it like an evolutionary process, or was it sort of parceled up by the time you got to it?
It was a constant evolution. It was really lovely. Obviously, we had Miranda, production designer, on board. We had Toby. We have Charlie. They all have strong ideas, but it was thousands of little conversations with myself and with the VFX vendors and concept artists. So initially it was going to be more like it was going to have a planet at the center of it and then these rings around it and it moved in a gyroscopic form. And that's where we began. But then there was, you know, because of the way the script evolved and just called for nobody to be wanting to land on something in the center and be hidden, we went darker and darker with it. We went more metallic. We tried lights, but it made it looked like people lived on it, and we didn't want people landing on it. So there was this constant evolution. We started off looking at there was the Dark Crystal, the woman who has the floating celestial room of objects that float around one another. And it began there. With hints of, obviously, this episode is an homage in thousands of ways to so many wonderful films and TV series. And another one was Event Horizon. There was the center of the gravity machine, how that moved. There was references to metallic guillotines and armillaries. And we went through this huge design process. We knew we wanted to have, Toby was very clear, along with Charlie, that they wanted it to chop in a way that it would rotate in a way that it was less predictable. So it was more ominous when we got into it. And so we had everything rotating in different directions and chopping down. And then quite a long way into the process, it was this metal object with sort of spiky hard edges and things. And then Charlie and Toby were sitting nutting out a few things and said, oh, wouldn't it be awesome if, because of gamification, if it was PCB boards and chips and stuff like that. And David and the team at Union jumped on that. And so they started building in all of these PCB boards and things. And they created, I think, 3 or 4 layers of textural and model detail so that we could use chunks, we could see it all the way up to being this entire sort of planet structure. So it was a real evolution. It was thousands of little conversations. It was a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
Of course, one of the things that let us as the audience see those levels of detail is the fact that, and you alluded to this earlier, there's the dogfight that's going in and on and around it. Talk to me about the choreography and the staging of that. You've already mentioned like you wanted to have the environment look like they couldn't land, but there's a lot going on there, and yet we don't want to lose orientation to where we are, to the heroes, as it were.
Yeah, so that was all about our key light. So obviously when you're looking at a lot of these, you know, Star Wars films and Star Trek films, you've got that single key light that's drifting in a window, a bit like the sunlight coming into my bedroom right now. So that gives you an understanding of sort of where is up. So we had the strong key light, which was behind the Heart of Infinity so that we would get it backlit, which is, you know, leaning into Stefan, the DOP's ideas on how you wanted to light these scenes. And that strong key light enabled us to do a whole bunch of things. We were able to light the small builds of the spacecrafts on the set. So we had a light on big moving arms that we were able to move around to make them feel like they were rolling. So those in-camera cockpit shots, when we have a rolling light, then we can cut to a wide and then we can continue that movement. We can have our key light in the appropriate situation. And then when we start to barrel roll the ships in full CGI shots, they tie in with our existing in-camera cockpit shots. So that was all designed and planned out fairly early. And then the other layer on top is obviously we have this structure where we began with paper planes, sat in a production office, and iPhones. Toby and Stefan and Josie Hinwood and myself, the VFX producer, playing around filming shots. Because obviously when you read the script and you see an initial edit, you get these big black slabs of slates that say space battle here. It's always a little bit daunting. So we went through a research project where we looked at all of the available material that's modern. Toby had obviously worked on Andor, so he had a strong background in that. I went back and looked at dogfights from World War II. I looked at car films, Rush, those kinds of, like, everywhere we were keeping energy and keeping motion and understanding a storyline.
What did you take from a film like Rush? Because that's not an immediately, I mean, dogfights from World War II is sort of a more obvious, you know, three-dimensional thing. But a car race, like, what were you taking from that?
Well,
what
did you sort of learn? It's the inside-outside, it's the cockpits and out, and working out what they were doing with the cockpits and the cameras in the cockpits, and then understanding how you can jump to a wide shot or a medium, working out what you require, whether or not you want to be facing forwards or backwards. Is the danger in front of you? Is it behind you? How do you want to structure your cameras and your angles? It was more that. Obviously, it plays out on a flatter plane than, you know, a car race is on a flatter plane. But I think the camera work in there is really lovely. I really enjoyed all of that. I haven't seen the latest F1 film yet. I want to see that. But we did. We had a look at Top Gun as well, the new Top Gun. So, you know, there's a few thousand references out there which are all wonderful things to sit down and watch as part of research for your work. So it's a hell of a career to be able to sit down and watch movies and understand that you're learning from.
Yeah. So talking about lighting and stuff, like in the actual main spaceship, there was a classic view screen, as you say, a bit of an homage to many sci-fi ships.
Yeah.
I believe you had an LED wall in that. Was that right? Like, talk to me about that and what it meant for just planning the shots.
Sure. So at the end of the previous show from the previous season, season four, they had a green screen in the ship for most of the scenes. And this time around, Josie Henwood and I sat down, and very early we worked out how many shots would it take before a green screen was no longer worth it, and we wanted to have all of this stuff in camera because of de-spill, because of keying, because of how they were structuring the shots. And we worked out a number, and that number was lower than what we expected to be shooting. So based on the boards and based on the scripts. So once we knew we had the possibility of an LED wall, we got Stefan involved, the DOP, and we did a quick test and we had a look on set. And what we rapidly realized, even with a very small LED panel just as a test, was how beautiful the surfaces and the caliper looked when all this light was bounced off, all the chrome navigation instruments, the metal surfaces, the chairs. But Stefan looked at it, and we ran some footage through it from some trailers from films and things, and he realized he could use it as a light as well, which he absolutely loved. So we set about making sure that we had a large enough screen. VSS were our screen supply guys, and they made us this huge, beautiful wall, and they were able to feed material through it on set and change it on the fly as we needed. So Union VFX and who was it? Terraform did the concepting of the planets. We were able to create 5K footage, which we could pan and scan around as we needed. We could rotate it. So if they wanted the planet for us to feel like we were under it or over it, we had a hyperspace that was really beautiful, which was traveling through the whole time. So all of this was designed before the shoot, given over to the VSS guys, and then we were able to play it on set live. I think the moment where we realized we'd really made the right decision actually had nothing to do with the script. We set up the screen, we got some space stuff playing through it, and then they closed off the set and they introduced the actors into the set for the first time. So they'd all seen the set before, previous season, but they came into it and just hearing them going, oh, wow, you know, like being more immersive with the screen in there really, really soldered in. And I think there's a clip on Instagram that you can see of them walking in and seeing it for the first time. And it's quite fun seeing their reaction to how they were going to interact with this environment and how it helped them.
You said you could vary it, obviously, you know, on the day, but how much was that so that you just had really good lighting and reference? And how much was that, well, okay, that are going to be final pixels?
Oh, a lot of the shots are final pixels. Okay. Yeah. So we had planet stuff. That, we didn't have the Heart of Infinity at that point in time designed. So the Heart of Infinity shots, we had to run a space background out there, and then we added the Heart of Infinity into it. The hyperspace was, for the most part, there. We did some sort of subtle color gradings and tweaks to it afterwards, but you could see it all bouncing off all the surfaces, and it's really beautiful. The planet stuff, Pixie's planet, Walton's planet, they were in camera. A lot of those were in camera. And anytime there's a reverse shot, so where we're facing the actors when we turn around, all of those are in camera because you don't have a big green screen or anything in there. So Stefan was able to use them to light them. You'd be amazed at how much light comes off, bounced light comes off a planet. So we always had the key light, and we always had a bounce light that was off a planet. And that helps with a little bit of fill. So those two elements, lighting elements in combination, really helped everybody. So, yeah, we got a lot of shots in camera.
I don't know if you want to share with us the actual number you referenced earlier, or if I just could hypothetically say I came to you with a project and we were thinking of having an LED screen for a spaceship. What that sort of number point is where you feel like, yeah, it's definitely worth getting this up and running versus shooting green screen. Like, do you have a gut feeling for that? Or? Sure.
We had a gut feeling when you read a script. So when I read a script, I can sort of, I've been doing it a while, so you can start to understand how it would play out. You know, okay, we'll be on their face at this time, but in the wide, we'll see that. And I would just sort of make markers along the way of whether or not we felt it was a wide, medium, close up, which angles we were guessing. And then it was literally, we know from our vendors, we had shot costs for medium, wide, close up. You know, the hair wasn't so much of an issue on this one. They were relatively clean lines. But it was working out how many shots we thought they'd be, what our budget for that section we thought would be, and then playing the two off against one another. And it was about, I think we were sort of, if we'd had 60% of the shots, we might have gone green screen. But we knew we reached a point where we knew we were over the value, as it were, of despilling and cutting mats and rotoing and you know, camera tracking and putting our content in. So, yeah, it just comes with a little bit of time and noodling it. Josie did a fantastic job breaking it all down.
Yeah. I also really like the transporter effects and the kind of like, you know, visual game stuff that you alluded to earlier, but now I'm talking at an individual level rather than at a sort of a ship level. Was that a evolution from what you'd done before? It felt like it was, some of it was quite new.
Yeah, it's all new. So what was interesting about the teleportation this time around, there was one in the previous one, but it was more of a 60s style teleportation. It was this golden light where they evaporated.
Because you had much more of a voxel effect this time.
Yeah, exactly. So the Toby and Charlie leaned into the idea that it's like a resolution. You're fine resolution, you deconstruct to these larger cubes. The cubes are then sent down as voxels, and then they increase in resolution when you arrive at the next place. So there's layers to it that you'll see within all of the teleportations where it's when it's nearer to you being a human, it's finely detailed, and then the cubes over time get larger and larger, and by the end they're sort of 3-inch by 3-inch cubes that send the data more efficiently, is probably the way to look at it. Yeah, it was really lovely effect. Obviously on set we created a with the lighting department, a lighting ring, which was really useful as well to sit on the ground so that it gave some a grounded area to go back to. You have to teleport in and out from the same point, the same space, for narrative reasons. So we had this 2-meter ring that the lighting department put together, which meant that we could get all this beautiful uplight on the characters, actors as they came in. You can see it in their visors. You can see it reflected in their arms and their costumes and legs. So the combination of that with the blue voxel design that came and went really tied together quite well.
Yeah, how far did you have to go into sort of doing digi doubles for the cast?
We scanned them and then we had digi doubles in poses. The cast were really brilliant at this. They really got the, they understood that you can't, they didn't want to move around too much because it looks odd when you're moving voxels around in a fixed space. So they held and then they would go and we would, they would be filmed in camera on the set in a pose that they deemed how they wanted to go down or up, depending on how rushed they were or the peril. And so they would hold a pose and then they would go. And up until that point, we would, David and the team at Union would pose the digi shape, the scan, the LiDAR scan of the characters into that pose so that it was a fixed pose at that point in time, and then run the voxels and run the designs. And then there'd be a quick takeover as the actors left set. So it worked really well up and down. You can see it in some of the teleporting up into the ship where there's up to four of them doing it at any one time. They did a cracking job, yeah.
So when I was watching, well, I was going to watch the episode and I was really enthusiastic about it. I said, I'm going to go back and watch the other episode first, right? So quite literally I watched the previous, you know, season four and then this one, one back to back. What I was struck by was just how much of an homage there was between the two eps. And so an example I raised independently of VFX was there's like a point where somebody comes into a room, they trip on a bag in the first ep, and I just happened to notice this was exactly what happened in your ep. And so I guess my question is, there must have been a bunch of those in visual effects as well as just in practical kind of building. Oh. And I just thought you might share a couple of favourites with us.
There's thousands of homages, not just back to the eps, but homages to other shows, other series, other...
But, I mean, these were like literally almost frame-for-frame reconstructions for no particular plot reason other than Uber fans like me just loved it and smiled.
Yeah, there's if you... Yeah, that, I mean, a lot of that was on Toby and Charlie. You know, they would write those in. They would be like, okay, we're going to do this here and that here. One fun one is I discovered on Reddit a few days ago that people are now pausing it and having a look and noticing things. All of the UI and UX was a lot of it was done in post-production and visual effects later. So you'll spot a lot of character names that reference not only previous episode of Callister, but the wider Black Mirror world. So you've got all of these... There's literally one that's in there that says, stop pausing this film and just watch the damn thing. Charlie wanted to use ruder words, but I think we got vetoed by some people. But there's thousands. I mean, there's a moment when the space battle begins where if you listen carefully, even sound we're doing in it, where you can hear Leroy Jenkins as the ships take off. There's the Willem scream. There's homages everywhere the whole way through. This is it's a beautiful piece to be able to work on because we were just layering in thousands of these things. It was a lot of fun, a lot of fun. There's obviously the guys from Demon 79 as well. They're in their ships at the end there. So they Angina and Papa came in. Papa's now in the latest Harry Potter. And they have their own ships, and their ships were designed around their characters from Demon 79. So there was hammers, and there was, if you look really closely, the attention to detail across how these worlds weave each other, you know, Tuckersoft and all of these people are sort of mentioned and dusted through the entire episode. The worlds are weaving together in quite a beautiful way. Yeah.
One of the common things throughout the seasons, as it were, is an idea of like, I'm going to put an implant or a some kind of neural connector on the side of my head, which leads to multiple shots in the show where somebody's eyes kind of change over. I'm just wondering, are they always digital, or is there like a sort of a contact lens thing, or what's the theory?
So we looked into the contact lens thing, but it can sometimes make some actors, not all actors, uncomfortable, and that can affect their performance. So we decided to lean into a digital version, but we did design some. There's a few ways we've done it in different episodes of Black Mirror, and Callister is its own design, the Milky Way that it turns on. And I did actually make some polymer resin eyeballs here at home and had them glazed and stuff, literally made them on my desk here and had them on like a little ball so that we, if we wanted to, we could do chrome balls, Macbeth charts, grey balls and eyeballs. So that was quite fun, and we had those on set for reference.
James, it's almost like you're having a good time when you're doing this show.
don't tell too many people, but it was, I mean, yeah, it's hard not, as a VFX supervisor who's a nerd and loves space battles and loves building things and talking to various departments about various ways we can do things and just deciding what the best pixels will get at the end are and how we can achieve that. And the collaboration of the departments on this was exceptional. It was so much fun. Yeah, it's hard not to do it with a smile.
You said you weren't on Callister when it first appeared, but obviously now, I'm not suggesting for a second that there's a third one, but were there lessons learned on this taking forward that, or would you, if you could go back and talk to yourself, you'd say, oh, I do this differently?
I think, yes, there's always stuff to learn. There's thousands of things to learn along the way. I think sometimes we obviously like to get a lot of light, bounce light on people's faces when they're near monitors. And I think some of the shots in Daly's garage, there's hundreds in there that are all VFX replacement shots. So all the screens in there were done by the companies like Magic Lab and Stargate. Jellyfish were on this as well. And
because that lab itself was just a gorgeous set and a bunch of homages and great
beautiful plot, right? And there was six monitors, so there was five main monitors, one monitor up the top, there was a vintage Mac, and because of that I think I would try and get more of those in camera. We had some in camera up on them, but I think we could probably push ourselves to get a bit closer with some of those monitors in camera. That's all blue screen, that set as well. So we shot that we shot the exteriors in a location in Maidenhead, and we shot the interior looking out with blue screen. So they're all plates and blue screen. That worked out well, but I think I'd probably try and get a few more monitors in camera. It's always quite nice for the DP to have a bit more to play with if they know exactly where the monitors are going to be luminance wise.
And presumably, as with the LED screen, it helps the actors, right? Not so much that they need it, but just to give them the consistency for the where they're at.
Yeah. And I think once you have the interface design structure and everything put together, you're essentially, we replaced the whole screen in some shots. We replaced portions of the screen in others. And I think the portions worked really well because it gave them a sense of what they were looking at, this UI, but a bit like our Zoom call here. I've got four or five other windows sat behind. It largely doesn't matter what they're doing. The focus is obviously on you and I. And I think that approach that we used in some of the monitors most of the time, because we didn't have the heart of Infinity, we couldn't put it in those screens at that point in time. We had little grey boxes. I think we'd do more of that, just to help the actors play off it.
Was that lateness just simply the production schedule, or was there like some massive changes that caused, I mean, it is obviously a huge asset, so.
What we wanted to do was make sure that we weren't locked into something that everybody wasn't happy with straight at the beginning. You know, there was thousands of conversations between loads of departments about how we structured that Heart of Infinity and what it looked like and how it worked. And you always try and push it for as long as you can, certain things, not everything, but with the Heart of Infinity, we needed to get it right. So we kept iterating, we kept going through concepting and designing and working with Union. How would this one move? How would this one look when it was backlit, frontlit, toplit? And all of those little discussions meant that we were constantly evolving it for as long as we could, to make sure that it was as impressive as it could be, as ominous as it could be. And so because of that, it wasn't ready when we were filming back in the summer in the garage, because that was an early set.
And I presume there was a bunch of what I'd call more traditional VFX, in the sense that there were like pedestrian traffic accidents, not to give too much away, but things that were dramatic, yeah, very unexpected, but more in the sort of traditional VFX mode.
Well, that one's an even stranger one. So, yes, we did help out on that. There was some wire removal. But also we found that because of that shooting location, when we put it in for an American audience, it felt wrong. So actually that whole scene is flopped left to right. So we made that decision later in edit. So because
does that mean there are two versions of the master, or the world saw the American
version? No, just one. It was to do with what side of the car, the road the car drove on.
Yeah.
It felt like it was slightly wrong for an American side of the road when we shot it here in Britain. And so we ended up flopping a lot of the shots where you see the car and you see the accident and you see the direction. But then when you flop it, you realize the number plate needs flopping, the logos on the head, the street signs, the parking sign, there's a whole lot of things in there that they all need flopping back the other way. So that was a little one that needed a bit of help. There was a lot of, cleanups and monitors, but also there was Rocky's face. There was a prop, Rocky, who's down on the planet with Walton. And the props department did a fantastic job of putting that all together and put a smiley face on it. But then there was a feeling that maybe Rocky looked like he was enjoying himself a little bit too much. So we had to slightly change Rocky's face in post-production in some shots, just for consistency, but also making sure he didn't feel like he was enjoying it too much. Yeah.
Yes, yes. There is a marvelous balance between comedy, sort of dramatic, sort of normal drama, I guess, and then kind of despair that makes it feel like it's a Black Mirror episode in the first place.
Yeah, it's a very fine balancing act. And bits that I thought read straight funny were comedy funny, or read comedy funny and were straight funny, and that was entirely on the actors and how they reacted on set,
Yeah, Kristen, I mean, obviously the actors were really good.
Oh, so good. Kristen and Jimmy were phenomenal.
They really were. But I also think there was really good direction, because there was really nice elements that were happening in the background at just that right balance where if you noticed them, they were very funny. But if you didn't notice them, it wasn't distracting, and also it didn't it wasn't a plot point that you felt like you'd lost something. And that sort of blocking and framing really works well.
There's a perfect moment for that, actually. It's wonderful that you've noticed all of these things. There's when they teleport in, the four of them, so the two clones and the real come up to the Callister. So we had to work out how to have pairs of actors on set at the same time. We used motion control. And some of it was full motion control on an arm, which was recorded by Stefan. So we had this ability to move the camera in a free handheld way, and that recorded the motion. And then we were able to shoot a plate with Nanette as real Nanette, and a plate with Kristen as real Nanette, and then a plate with Kristen as clone Nanette, and the same with Jimmy as real Walton and clone Walton. And there was this beautiful moment. They rehearsed. They did. It's a dance with motion control. You have to be very careful.
Was this like a full Milo rig, or was it like a sort of a smaller setup?
Yeah. So there was a big crane arm with control Technicrane dolly control head on the front.
Right. So it's really a sophisticated rig.
Sophisticated rig. We used the whole gamut. We used handheld. Ed, the camera operator, did moves a couple of times. When you're pushing into the teleporter, that's not motion control. So that was our camera editor and lighting crew lining up plates and hitting go, so that our lighting teleport happened at the same time. So that was a very human approach. We had track and dolly, so we were able to slightly, get close with fake motion control. We had dirty shoulders, so we had a body double. But yeah, the motion control rig was the really fun one.
And I interrupted you because you're about to discuss about the background, and I didn't mean to ruin your anecdote, but
No, it's all good. So it all comes to so going full circle, Jimmy comes out of the transporter as clone Walton, and walks over to Real Walton and hands himself a drink. And that sounds relatively easy, but is massively complicated when you're not understanding where you need to be at what time. It's a dance. And Jimmy must have seen how the first take played out, where he was the real him, and he hands this drink over. And he hit it every time, and he hit it bang on. And we had overlay on set, and we in the VFX department were like high-fiving each other because Jimmy hands himself a drink at the perfect moment. And then about 2 or 3 months later, we got into the edits and Nanette was delivering a really important emotive line. So the camera wasn't facing Jimmy. It was 180 degrees around on Nanette's face. And we were like, oh, it's so disappointing to not see that. But understandably, the show required to be on Nanette at that point in time.
Yeah. Well, I presume in a show that's well run like this, there wasn't a lot that ended up on the cutting room floor that was cut from the show. But I'm sure it happens on everything, right?
Yeah, there was a few moments where we were running and gunning. You can see some great shots of Toby on the front of the cockpit as he's yelling and screaming, and we're moving lights over, and we're keeping all of this energy going. There was a lot to choose from. It was really good. There was a lot of, I think with the comedy, Toby had to be, as you say, it's really curated very well in terms of the comedy moments and the drama moments, because obviously we're bouncing between, you know, space battles and two people having an intense conversation down in a very confined little space. So maintaining that sort of thread through multiple scenes towards the end of the show was a balancing act, and Toby had a lot of it in his head, but he was also able to shoot it in a way that he had options in the cutting room with Tony, our editor. So it was really good. I don't think we ever came up short for want or need of content.
No, that was great. James, I've done like 1,000 podcasts, quite literally, and like I've been doing this for 25 years, and I'm going to do something I've never, ever done before. I'm going to comment on your wardrobe. That is an amazing shirt. That's a Pac-Man shirt. I'm sorry. I just can't let it go by without noting. Just know that I've never mentioned that ever before to anyone, and I'll probably get hate mail for mentioning it now, but that is just one awesome freaking shirt, mate.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's one of my favorites for sure. It comes out fairly regularly. Yeah. It does get a lot of comments. Yeah.
Yeah. I understand why. Thank you so much for taking us through your work, man. Really, really appreciate it.
Oh, mate, I can't thank Effects Guide enough. You know, I began my career many, many years ago, and you guys have created something that is a constant resource for so many of us in this field. It's a massive honor to be interviewed by you. Your name first came up in Flame user groups back in the early 2000s for me. So it's awesome to be able to help you out, hopefully, a little bit.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. And thank you for the kind words. That's very, that's good. Well, again, I like look forward to seeing what you come up with next, because I'm, like, as I said, a diehard fan. I'll out-nerd you on some of that stuff at a moment's notice. But again, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
No worries. Well, thanks, guys, for that. And thanks so much, James, for taking the time to chat with us. That's it for this episode of the FX Podcast. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.